Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning, honorable members, EG and the colleagues. With that will be the contents of the presentation. By and large, Chairperson, the strategic objectives of NEDLAC have not changed. I will come back briefly to highlight some of the aspects that we have changed, which are quite cosmetic. I will come back to that. In terms of our NEDLAC program, we have three programs at NEDLAC. We do our work through administration, cooperation, and constituency capacity building. And in terms of our indicators, for administration, we have 10 indicators. And for core programs, we have 28 constituency capacity building, we have six. And the total of performance indicators is 44. I'll just delve into the budget. In terms of the budget for 2018-2019, we have a grant, as indicated in the Department of Labor presentation, of 33.5 million rand, and we have an interest from our call accounts of about 603,000 rand that we are expecting, and other income, which is the disposal mainly of equipment that we no longer need and use, of 147,000. So the total budget for the year is 34.3 million rand. Just to illustrate how that is divided. Program 1, which is accommodation, takes the biggest chunk, which is 23.4 million rand. And Program 2, which is core operations, takes 6.5 million rand. And Program 3, capacity building funds, takes 4.3 million rand. In terms of summary of our expenditure, slide 14, like for in terms of our summary of expenditure, we have, as indicated, Program 1, 23.2 million rand, but we also have capital expenditure of about 200,000 rand for this financial year, and Program 2, 6.5, Program 3, 4.3, and that will grow by about 5.5% for the two coming years, which is financial years 2019-2020, and grow also about 5.5% in 2020-2021. We will then move to slide 25, which is just an indication, a brief on the revised strategic plan. As I have indicated, that we haven't made much changes there. We move to slide 26. In terms of the 2015-2016, 2019-2020 strategic plan has been amended to ensure alignment of terms used throughout the document and to ensure that performance indicators are smart. So that's basically what we have done. And some indicators that were deemed as being of less strategic imperative were therefore not recorded on the AMP. And they were then incorporated in what we have now developed as the operational plan as advised by the department. That is just an indication of some of the changes that we have made in terms of ensuring that the strategic objectives are smart and those that we have moved to the operational plan. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. I think that's a record. Honorable members, we are are noting hands. I think it's very clear, Honourable Baker. Any other hands? You are on the floor, Honourable Baker.
Thank you. Just to go to the veracity or the need for NEDLAC, and maybe you could just address us on that. Many people now over the National Minimum Wage have said that many of the agreements that were reached at NEDLAC were not even translated into the bills that were eventually drafted. And it appears that NEDLAC was almost ignored. We had that beforehand with the previous amendments to the labor relations. You had spent, I think, about 2 years, maybe 3 years, debating the National Minimum Wage. Parties had spent that time to great expense and time and effort, and somehow it didn't translate into reaching the bill, which upset some of the trade unions. And maybe you want to comment on that. I've made the comment as well myself that it's often just a touch telephone. Everyone's talking, but no one's listening. That being said, I still think there's a great necessity for NEDLAC to exist, and maybe you could just let us know about that. And that there is a need to actually spend the funding that NEDLAC is spending. The other thing I wanted to talk about, and you again also this capacity building. I mean, I'm not entirely sure what it is. Maybe you can expand a little bit on that for me. Or what do you mean by constituency capacity building? I tried to understand that in the past, and I've somehow not been able to grasp what it actually means, because there is spending on that. And then finally, obviously, you are faced with the current issue with SAFTU saying that they've been left out of NEDLAC and your legislation that would allow them in for the next year. Maybe you want to comment on that. And then, of course, what has been raised on numerous occasions, and I know the answer you're going to give, but what has been raised is that the voice of the unemployed don't really exist. I don't believe they exist at all within NEDLAC. You're going to say that's the community faction, but I'm not sure how that feeds into the voice of the unemployed. So maybe you can help us out there.
Thank you. Thank you, Honourable Baker. Any other comments? The floor is yours.
Thank you, Chairperson. I was interested with the issue of the need for NEDLAC and the allegation that many of the agreements that were reached in the negotiations at NEDLAC were not included in the bill. I think the department has spoken at length on this, and as the person that has participated in all these negotiations at NEDLAC, I know for a fact that it's not true. You must just pinpoint what is it was not included. There is nothing that was not included. An agreement was signed on the 7th of February last year, National Minimum Wage Agreement, and everything in that agreement has been included in the bill. And some of the matters that were agreed upon in the negotiations that NEDLAC will be dealt with once the National Minimum Wage Commission is in place. So there's a lot of work that will be ongoing once the National Minimum Wage is implemented. So it's not exactly correct that there are certain agreements. Certainly, we're not aware of any omissions in terms of the agreement. Someone can point out that this is what was agreed and not. Perhaps it's people that were not participating at NEDLAC that may say that. I think the NEDLAC is the creature of the statute. I don't think it's up to me to evaluate the need for its existence, but as a person operating there, I see the need of having a network. For example, we are busy right now discussing comprehensive social security. That's a forum where the social partners come and share ideas and put forward proposals that are quite constructive that will end up finally here in Parliament as legislation. That also applies to the national health insurance, which is quite groundbreaking, which NEDLAC is grappling with. And in terms of the second question on constituency capacity building fund, what is that? That is the money that is given to constituencies. For example, all three constituencies, excluding government, have what employees that they've hired that are placed at NEDLAC to do coordination work for them. It goes to their salaries, but also constituencies may need capacity building in terms of training their own members to participate in that. For example, Labour has what is called a Labour School. They call all their participants into that Labour School over 3 to 4 days and have all the experts that they need to deal with the program that will be undertaken in that particular year. They do that almost religiously every January. So those funds help there, but the other constituencies may want to be assisted in terms of research. For example, we have currently discussions around comprehensive social security. Business community may say we need additional research on this. That's the fund that they use for that. So that's how those funds are used. And in terms of staff to the allegation that staff has been left out of NEDLAC, that is also not true. Staff could not have participated in the national minimum wage deliberation building up to the agreement that was signed on the 7th of February last year because in terms of the law they were non-existent then. They only existed after they registered in April 2017. And then they never applied for membership of NEDLAC until the 7th of March this year, the 6th of March this year. So they have applied now. Their application is being considered in terms of the protocol of NEDLAC. Obviously, constituencies in terms of the NEDLAC Constitution and the NEDLAC Act can amend their requirements, and last year their requirements before SAFTU came on board were amended. One of the requirements there is that any trade union federation that wants to be part of NEDLAC must at least produce annual financial statements, audited annual financial statements for 2 previous years. So that's one requirement which is part of the NEDLAC protocol right now. So obviously the constituency that is dealing with that is the Labour constituency. Eventually, I'm sure SAFTU will be part of NEDLAC. It may not be part of NEDLAC right now, but in good time they will meet all the requirements that are there. And of course, Honorable Bahrain said about the voice of the unemployed. As you are aware, that it's one of their platform for representation, the community constituency. But we also regard the government as a representative of all South Africans because they don't necessarily represent themselves. they see different structures. Government represents all of us, the unemployed and the employed. Over and above that, you also have the community constituency represented by 6 broad community organizations. So, but that can be reviewed as and when we go on. There are ways of introducing new participants in NEDLAC in terms of the community constituency. If there is a need to do that, it may be done in the future. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. McCarthy, Honorable Reagan.
Willie said I should follow up. When we took evidence or input from the organisations on the national minimum wage. You say it's not true that the things are left out. Well, these trade union movements, the three trade union umbrellas, all complained that what was agreed at NEDLAC was not translated into the bill. Maybe they were lying, I don't know, but I wasn't there, so I can't really tell. But I just thought maybe you should go and read their inputs that came here. Also, the input that came from BITS and UCT also, and the community also said it wasn't followed. So maybe someone should give you those documents to have a look, and maybe you can comment if you haven't had a look at them. You also said that the 2 years, you need 2 years worth of books, audits of 2 years. Obviously, then what you really say is that some two won't be able to join for the next 2 years because they need to have 2 years worth of audits. But that's an internal regulation, so why can't you just change it? You know that they're the second biggest umbrella body, probably destined to be the biggest umbrella body, so maybe it's worth looking at, and I just wanted you to comment on that. And then finally, you did say, and thank you for that, you're having a look at the voice of the unemployed, and maybe not just through the community and government. There should be some other way. But you did say you were going to look at that. I presume you're going to put that on your agenda to have a look at. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. The issue of changing the rules, obviously, the criteria for membership at NEDLAC emanates mainly from the constituencies themselves. Obviously, as the Secretariat, we can also propose some of these things, but the constituencies themselves come up with these amendments if they want changes to be made. And there was good reason that was articulated by the Labour constituency at NEDLAC as to why we should have these conditions for membership. And obviously, if that holds, SAFTU may not, if they may not be members of NEDLAC at least for the next 12 months, because after the end of April next year, they would have done 2 years. They would have existed for 2 years. So it's something that the labor component should be raising.
Thank you, Mr. Balakandri. Honorable
Mashile. Chairperson, I think one would appreciate that NEDLAC has got different components of people that they are managing and financing, especially with the constituencies and their operations. And one would love to understand the capacity that they have to monitor the performances of all those sectors that they are spending money on, and also how they monitor their own performance. If you could just try and speak to their internal arrangements and the capacity that they have to actually ensure that they achieve these targets that they are living. Thanks.
Thank you, Honorable Mashiri.
Thank you, Chairperson. In terms of managing the funds that we deploy and give to the constituencies, obviously we follow normal procurement processes at NEDLAC in order for the funds to be used. There was in the past few years findings from the Auditor General when the constituencies themselves were sourcing out service providers and paying them directly and just send invoices to NEDLAC. That has stopped since last year. And now all capacity building activities that are undertaken by the constituency are submitted to NEDLAC and subjected to the supply chain management policies of NEDLAC. So that's how we manage that. And in terms of ensuring that we reach our targets as articulated in the APP, we have performance agreements with staff at NEDLAC to ensure that they implement this, and we do, like all other entities of state, performance assessments on a quarterly basis. And in terms of the performance of NEDLAC and reaching the targets, we are quite happy because on average, we reach 90% of the performance targets that NEDLAC is supposed to reach. And one area or source of pride for us is that since we started last year to achieve an unqualified audit opinion with findings, of course, which is something that we intend on improving in this phase of the auditing of the books of NEDLAC. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Mr.
Farid.
Chairperson, I'm going to, I know the time pressures. I'm going to focus on the key aspects, both on the financial and the non-financial portion of the report. I will just proceed straight to page 6 of the presentation. I think that gave an indication just one aspect there, that on the first point, that as far as our targets are concerned, in our strategy, we moved from 15 targets to 19 targets. That's what's required. And then the second part, which is the two important points that we wish to highlight there, in terms of our strategy, in terms of our movement forward. With regards to dispute management and prevention, and second, the improved collective bargaining. Now, Chairperson, the biggest enemy for us in fully exploring this tool is purely the financial issue. What we are trying to move towards as the Commission and in collaboration with all other entities and stakeholders is for the labor market to accept, implement, and expand the principle of dispute management and prevention. Because most of the work that we do, if you look at our mandatory functions in terms of the LFA, you will note that mostly it's a reactive function because of cases that we receive. But if we can, because we do have problems, we do have models, we do have instruments that we have designed and we are applying them to a limited extent, because they're quite costly to do, but the idea that we're trying to instill, and we will not stop to instill that principle, is that of finding ways of preventing disputes. Because there are instruments that we can apply for us to prevent disputes. And for those that we can't prevent, we must be able to manage them so that we can mitigate its effect in as far as the federal cases is concerned. So the real test for the Commission with all the stakeholders, is that if we can succeed in doing this problem, we will be able to deal with the large cases that we have. And now, before the amendment, without even the minimum wage amendment and the basic conditions that we're expecting, our caseload is sitting already above 195,000 cases. So we're heading towards the 200,000 cases on normal cases before the amendment. Because the expected increase as far as the minimum wage is concerned is going to be in the region of 30% or plus. That's a conservative number. But in the mix of that 10%, as we try to design our strategy, we wanted to include this with management expense. It is there, but on a limited scale. With resources expanded, it will have a very direct impact on our case disbursement cost, as you will see also when you're doing the budget, and also the number of cases that we have. The second part, and a very important part, is on improved collective bargaining. Now, the idea in the chairperson, there's a number of tools that we've developed, that we've done, that we're doing. And then to give a very good example, if you have a strike like the one that's happening now, the bus strike, there's a lot that can be done prior to it reaching the level of reaching the average. By engaging in certain conferences, I'll talk about it when we get to some of the targets that we have included in our APP. So it is most about the collective bargaining process during and after process that we must engage in, so that we can manage this kind of process. It's not to engage at the time when the parties already are in dispute, because at that time a lot is happening. So it's pretty much difficult to manage that. So in our APP, we tried to include these improved collective bargaining programs, which we will be implementing much stronger in 2018-2019. But we hope that the buy-in from the parties that are engaging is high, especially now we know there's an impending one as well on the wage deal within the public sector. And the public sector is quite huge. On the employment security chapter, we're okay, and I'll talk to that target as soon as we get to the specific target. Now let's proceed to page 7. Now, on page 7, chapter 10, on the providing thought leadership, what we've done, and in 2017-18 financial year, we've tested one important thing which has worked quite well, which is part of the thought leadership principle that we're implementing. Convening a shop steward conference, convening a labor law conference. And both of them have been very successful, extremely successful. And we're very proud to have staged those two inaugural conferences because its content has been quite beneficial to the attendees that came to the conference. Not only did it inform the different federations that attended, and even those that are not in the union, and the experts that presented in those conferences, but we have grown as an organization to understand our users on what they need, and also how we should be treating them, how we should be servicing them. Because for us, while we understand our secretary function, but it is important also to understand whether the way we are servicing our users, we are really doing the right thing. So what we've learned from these two conferences is that we should hold them over a period of 3 days because they've made very good suggestions. So all these employment law changes that are happening, the current and the changes that are happening, and where we should be going, we've managed to extract from these thought leadership processes that we've engaged with those key stakeholders successfully. The one that is upcoming, which is for business, for small businesses, we've developed an important web tool to accommodate how we also, you know, how small businesses participate in the labor market, how we as a system can assist them with the ready information without the extreme cost that is associated with labor disputes. So together with the ILO and BUSA, we have managed to develop that program. It has been completed. It is due for implementation in June. So this thought leadership part as a key component of our strategy, we are going to implement that in 2018 and 2019 and beyond. And I know that that is in line also with the government outcomes that we expected to achieve. Another expansion, Jefferson, which we did in the previous financial, in the previous strategy, but which we are expanding, is the one that deals with the capacity building on effective negotiation skills. We not only now keeping the effective negotiation training within the consumer users only. We are now expanding this to the public council because we believe strongly that the type of skilling that we are talking about on negotiation is quite critical also for the bargaining council, because the bargaining council is a mirror of what we have in the commission. And the only difference is that there's different sectors there. We cannot underestimate the importance of the effective negotiation skilling for the parties that appear before commissioners, because it is one thing to have a commissioner that is competent, but the parties that appear before you at least must be equally competent to be able to have an effective negotiating process. It does have a bearing on the period of negotiations. It also has a bearing on the quality of the outcome that comes from it. So in our current target, we have planned to have 20 of those capacity buildings covering those areas I've just explained on code of good practice and everything else that comes with that. So that covers also. The one baby that we created, which we continue to support, which is struggling at the moment, is the private agencies. We created four private agencies as a means also to try to ease the pressure on the cases on the bargaining council from the CCMA. They are still really struggling at the moment in as far as work is concerned. And the one that is really doing well, I guess, is the dog issue. But the other ones that we established are quite struggling to do that. So we are going to assist them with capacity building in the context that we've explained. The one thing that you also note on the same page 7, just immediately after that, is the advocacy campaign on the minimum wage, in particular on the Code of Good Practice. We just planned one advocacy campaign. But this is not training. It's just an advocacy as far as the Code is concerned on the minimum wage. The entire bulk of the minimum wage, you will see Jefferson is actually not part of this, not even in the budget, because at this stage we're just working on the normal budget and the strategic plan. It will have to be loaded over and above what we are actually doing now. So that's why you want to see that. The last part, which is the advancement of employment security, the target of 35% in us attempting to save jobs remain unchanged. We struggled with the target, chapter 17-18, but we managed to achieve it 86% on that job save, because that's the number of employees who are facing retrenchment. So we have done well there. So we did not see a need to change that target accordingly. Now, proceeding to page 8, now, when I referred to the collective bargaining as a priority, this is where it's found in our APP. That we are going to hold two collective bargaining pre-bargaining conferences. The pre-bargaining conference is when you bring the commission before the collective bargaining process starts. So we intend to do so in 2018 and 2019. And then I will not take you through in detail something as far as the structures and what is established as far as collective bargaining is concerned. Now, we also added in the last portion of page 8, one of the challenges that we face is that the LRA, the Labor Relations Act, is expecting us to participate in the workplaces to transform them. And we are expected as the Commission, not just to do cases, but to ensure that we play our role with our expertise, that there are transformative processes that have happened in the workplace. So as a test, but the only big challenge we have is resources, because I mean, if you can just consider the number of workplaces would need to come, it's quite a lot. But for now, as a testing ground, we have identified for, and implement the instruments and the models that we've developed for purpose of transformation. But with capacity, we're more than willing to increase that so that we can achieve the objective of the LRA stated in chapter 1 of the Act. Proceeding to page 9, this is a normal thing that we do in keeping it, because this is one of the core functions that we do in the Commission, the capacity building of our users. We plans 96, that's what we can afford in this country. 96 capacity buildings throughout the country in educational reasons. This does not necessarily include the minimum wage. That one is a special program, which we discussed also in our meeting with the Management Committee. We will have an intermediate program with the Department of Labor to execute on the national minimum wage capacity. And in some of them, we're going to mix. We're going to have other statistics with the minimum wage. But the minimum wage is a special program. Jefferson, the reason why I'm saying it's a special program, and I keep saying this, when we are talking about minimum wage, we must never consider the minimum wage as the minimum wage legislation or the minimum wage act only. The minimum wage has influenced other employment law legislation. That, in the main, that is the main one that is affected is the Basic Conditions of Employment Act. Together with that, it affects employment equity and to a certain extent, the UI related legislation. So the extent of talking about minimum wage must be understood in that context. So what we must educate and what we must capacitate our users and certain specific sectors is exactly within that context. So the number of the capacity building exercises that you see is far less than what we will actually be doing. It's much more than, it's almost double that number of what we're supposed to be doing so that we can ensure that the labor market is prepared to engage in our programs and also in the bargaining process. Now I proceed to page 10. In page 10, Jefferson, one of the things, one of the difficult decisions to make is setting targets that you know that they're going to be difficult to achieve, but possible. And one of the things that we have not done in the past, which we are doing now, is to include our legislative mandate into our APP. Whether it's in the APP or not is what we have to do anyway. But in order for us to be effective in service delivery, in ensuring that the delivery that we make in as far as our statutory mandate is concerned, we've decided to include that into our APP. And there's two main activities there. One is that when cases are referred to the Commission, they must be dealt with in the first 30 days. And there have been a number of cases that were done outside that 30 days. We know that it's going to affect us in terms of our APP, but our concern is not about the effect it has on the APP. The idea is we are qualitatively engaging our functions internally in terms of our strategic objectives to make sure that we deliver quality services. The second part of that is the delivery of the awards. It is a question of law, not of strategy, that the awards delivered by the commissioners must be delivered within 14 days. But we've added that in our strategy, that when we know that commissioners, and sometimes, I mean, most of the time, it's not commissioners who fail to submit awards within 14 days. Largely it's affected by the administrative process that we engage in producing the award. Just in short, Jefferson, once a commissioner has done a case, he has 14 days to deliver the award to the party. But internally, they have 10 days to deliver the award, because in that process, what you include is what we call the quality assurance, where an award must be verified, it must be perused to make sure that it is implementable, it's within the parameters of the law, and generally that there's nothing wrong with it, then we authenticate that. Normally in that process you find that the communication between the commissioner and the administration, there's a problem there, and then the award is delivered late. And once the award is delivered late, it affects our APP, as you would have seen in the previous annual performance. That's exactly what it was. That's why you see our performance, as you said, it was about 100%, but we achieved about 99.9%. It is because of those type of issues. But we're not afraid to set a target that we know is going to set us back, but we knew that it's a target that must be done, because it's important, because it's a legal matter, rather than a strategic matter. The other important target in the same category has to do with essential services. One of the biggest challenges that we have with essential services is this what we call the minimum service agreement. Jefferson, there's still a struggle in ensuring that minimum service agreements not only are they concluded, but those that are concluded are managed, they are also implemented. We don't have much teeth that we can apply for those that do not meet or do not implement the minimum service agreement. That includes also the minimum service determinations and you know, essential services determinations and all of this. It's all about question of monitoring that there's compliance and observance. One, it is the statutory function to do so, but we want to make sure that at least a minimum of 10 of those is done for the purposes of 18-19. The last chapter is matters of which relate to strategic objective 4, which has to do with issues of governance, issues of compliance, and issues of risk management. If you look at our five strategic priorities that we've set as the CCMA, one of which is about governance, is about compliance, is about risk management. It is our intention also to lead to at least reach in this financial year, in this strategy, a maturity level of at least level 4, which I think will be a very good deal. So that almost in the department also, it is the same, almost the same target. Now, in addition to that, issues of training and continuous, I'm not going to talk to that because I think that's quite so as far as the non-financial part, that is as far as the ACL is concerned from the strategy for 2018-2019. Now, how does this match with the budget? Now, let me proceed straight. I will not waste too much time on that part. But one thing that I must make very clear to them. Let's proceed to page 14. Slide 14. Now, if I can start with this budget spread, what is critical and what is now, at least the DG is trying to assist us in this regard. And I know we've got scheduled meetings also to try to deal with this tension. The budget of the CCMA increases normally on a 5.6%, right? And DG has spoken about the one-off grants that we got for recordings, which is important for the outlying areas and the system that have. There's been judgments against us because tapes get lost, others are corrupted, and we said you must change the system. So we found a system we've implemented and we're implementing it. So we got help for that. But the tension that we have with the department here is that the budget that you see is a budget that does not include the minimum wage work that is done. It's just a normal budget. The 5% increase is a normal increase. But the bulk of work that is coming as a member now is not included. That's the tension that we have. And that's what the DG is trying to help us to sort out. Because we really, really worried about this part. Because not only is it about budget issue, it's about failure to do so will not implement the minimum wage and all the changes that we're talking about. So we are trying to use what we have, even though what we have on normal cases is not meeting, we're not breaking even in terms of what we should be having. Now the load on the minimum wage will blow out of the water. That part I can say very clear. And to that extent, it's quite problematic for us, and we really don't know how we're going to do this, because we're really trying to find a way with the DG on how really we can have somebody or treasure somebody to just understand that to implement the minimum wage in the basic conditions, you need resources, not just to add the function. We accept the function very well in terms of what it's about and what it's intended to achieve, and our collaboration with inspection and enforcement in as far as enforcing the legislation is concerned, we are clear about what needs to be done. The only challenge that we have is that the work is not matching the money we need to do it. And material, not just minimum, material is doing that. So as we head towards that, I just want the committee to know that DG has explained it, just to confirm it from our part, that with the limited resources that we have, we are heading for a disaster in as far as the implementation is concerned because of the budget constraint. That is as bluntly as I can put it. What we don't want to see, like we're having a bus strike now. We have a commissioner that is there that sat last night until 12 o'clock in the evening trying to resolve the bus strike. And then 12 o'clock negotiations break down. But you wake up in the morning, 5 o'clock, the commissioner must be there. But that's the commissioner you must pay while doing that. But But this one now is different, because while we integrate with inspections and enforcement, in as far as the minimum wage is concerned, while there's an increase in the capacity of inspectors that do the inspections, that's the inspections, but it's not commissioners. We need commissioners to deal with cases that come from the department, that comes to the commission, to deal with those cases. We don't have those commissioners to do that. We don't have the numbers. That excludes those that approach us directly for the cases, because it's not exclusively coming from the department only. There's others that, in terms of the legislation, that will be coming directly to us. And we must provide that service to implement the minimum wage. Because if we are unable to do so, then the legislative purpose of creating that minimum wage will collapse. Because we won't be able to do it. There will be a backlog of cases. It will frustrate the entire legislative purpose. So that's why we're cracking our heads with the DG to try to find a way so that we can fund it, because it's not included in the budget. And this is the message that I want to very, very clear, that it's not part of this budget on that expected volume of work that is coming, let alone that we can manage. You will see also the spread in our budget. If you look at, we've got those programs, the administration, institutional, corporate, social, and the administration and social services, which is where the core function is sitting, it's the same. It's just the only difference that we increased by 5.6%. It was in 17-18 and the year before that. So it will always be like that. So, but the picture will look different once you talk about that in the context of the minimum wage. The 988 that you see is inclusive not only of the grant, which is 963, you saw in the presentation by Department of Labor. It includes the interest we gained from investing the funds we get from the grant, which is about 13 million rand. In addition to that, you have also the money that we generate from the services that we do, not the core functions, like when we're requested to do certain special training, when we do the arbitrations by inquiry by arbitrator. Like you told, you are allowed to charge, but you only charge a limited fee in as far as that part is concerned. So we've managed to raise funds in as far as that portion is concerned, which we call the other income. The other portion, which is part of that 988, it is the sheriff fee. The sheriff fee, and this I must explain. The sheriff fee is the fee that we use to assist vulnerable workers to implement the awards that we make. This was a very effective and a very efficient decision made by the Department of Labor here that said, you make awards, but the bulk of vulnerable workers that are supposed to benefit from the awards that you make are unable to do so because the employer is refusing to reinspect. Not only that, they are refusing to pay the money that you systematically they must pay. When they go to the sheriff immediately pays them 10,000 rand, they can't afford it, and they disappear, the award disappears. So it's pointless. Then what we do in the system, we then say, we pay for the cost of the sheriff, but execute the award as an issue, the warrant of execution. So we've got about 3.5 million rand in as far as that function is concerned. But what you must expect, because it is about enforcement, and the pay disputes that come from the minimum wage are coming to the CCMA. So therefore, it's going to have a direct challenge on that thing. Because it's no longer just now the normal cases that we do. What you're facing now is a bigger part of mainly pay disputes that come to the CCMA as far as the minimum wage is concerned. You pay me 19 rand, it comes to us. There's a compliance order, it comes to us. We must enforce and execute within this context. But if we can't afford it, it means we can't do that part of the execution. That's the direct result and the challenge that we have in as far as that part is concerned. So the 988 that we have is composed of that. It's the grant, the other income that we make, and the interest based on that. But the case as it is, even before minimum wage, it is not sufficient. So, Chairperson, this is supplemented by the actual allocation as per the strategic objectives that we have. We have four strategic objectives. We've always been presented. I'm not going to go back and take it back to that. And the core function of what we do, the case disbursements, and all of it, is sitting on strategic objective for which is on slide number 15. On strategic objective, which is the optimization of organization, the commissioner, the case disbursement, interpretation, all of it are sitting there. This also is under strain because of just of what I've just explained. So that's essentially what our budget structure is like, Chairperson, from the strategic objectives, which is 1 to 4, as per our strategic objectives, the strategic plan, and are covered on the different problems of our budget. Other than that, everything else is the normal thing that we do. Yeah, that's basically my, that's our presentation.
Thank you, Mr.
Moore.
But we know you just like that. I think before we give to the members, you kept on referring to the issue of the DG, especially in terms of this national minimum wage budget and things. I think before we give to the members, I'll allow the DG to respond to that issue, because it seems as if you referring to the DG needs to handle that, needs to sort it out, but you are not informed about any plans that are in place to address your concerns. So at this stage, I want to give to the DG just to explain to us before we give to the members. DG.
Thank you, Chairperson. The National Director of the CCMA is right, Chairperson. The funding we've got from National Treasury for the CCMA excludes the enforcement element that will come together. And in our rationalization of that decision, we made the assumption that maybe National Treasury, in their foresight, they probably knew that we're going to struggle with the implementation of the national minimum wage, let alone the implementation, but the completion of the legislation itself. So they knew that we're not going to start on the 1st of May. And in the discussions that we had, we at least agreed that when we do the adjustments, we should do normally around July, August, we will factor this. Now, in the course of running the CCMA and the course that will be associated with the enforcement, we will make a determination as to how much to require, and we may be able to carry the cost this year from our own savings as a department on the good, I mean, good, what is the term?
Goods and services.
And then in the new financial year, which is 2019-18, when we have to submit the request for funding to the National Treasury, we will again do that. Because we at least will have a sense of how much does it cost them. Because currently we don't know. We whatever discussions we made are based on assumptions. So this year will sort of serve as a test case. Where we would know exactly how much I want to spend the cases that we refer. Because remember, we're not spending, we're not incurring costs when we're referring cases to the labor court. But certainly there were costs that were associated with the work that were incurred by Department of Justice or the labor court. So those costs are now transferred to the CCMA. We just need to establish how much it will cost, but we working together to make sure that as a result of this, they don't collapse, that business continues.
Thank you, Gigi, for that one. I'm noting the Honorable Derek and the Honorable Baker, Honorable Machine, the Honorable Matisha, and the Honorable Gorani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, BG, for that explanation. We picked it up earlier when you presented your budget, and it was quite evident that the anticipated increase caseload was not factored in for next year as well, and it's even quite concerning that current operations, the budget had been increased for the next financial year. But on a lighter note, thank you, Director, for the presentation and congratulations on your audit outcomes. Once again, you have demonstrated that your entity is a well-run entity that believes in good corporate governance and good financial management. And whatever resources are allocated to you, that you will use it in the best interest of achieving your objectives. Having said that, thank you for the explanation of the 988 million grand question of the resources. Yeah, exactly. It's still a little 29 and 20 as well. Makes sense to me now, to my colleagues as well. Having said all of that and the need for additional financial resources, that we know it's an infinite sort of source. There are always competing interests and priorities. Have you considered, you know, because I know it's something that is, you know, very reluctant on the part of your commissioners in particular to implement, is to award cost orders to increase your internal revenue. I'm sure there are employers who could possibly be held liable for cost given the increase in caseload. And then lastly, Director, you also spent quite a bit of money to bargaining councils to do dispute resolution work. And I know bargaining councils have their own reporting and accountability structures, but us here and yourself as an entity, who holds the bargaining councils accountable? Because you are under strict sort of accountability measures as a CCMA, but certainly somewhere along the line, the efficiency of bargaining councils and they're executing the mandate which they get subsidized need to be scrutinized. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Honourable Honourable
Thank you. I've just got to put down a disclaimer right up front before I ask all the questions, in that I'm a user of CCMA on a regular basis, so I am biased. So I just want to put that disclaimer. I do want to say that your statement about a 30% increase of caseload, now we're on 200,000 about now at the moment. If you have a 30% caseload increase, and it's going to be probably in the beginning quite a complicated caseload, that's over probably about a 50% need on your budget, which I think is going to be horrific. And I'll get back to what the DG has to say afterwards, but I don't buy what he has to say. I do want to comment on a couple of things. The preventing disputes issue is fantastic, and it probably is acting as the bulwark to this country descending into a lot of chaos. We could have a hell of a lot more chaos, and to see when Honourable Magician in the 80s led chaos in our economy. You can avoid that today. And I would suggest spending more time and money on that, because that could be a real problem. Your effort into going outsourcing training of commissioners to the universities, I think we also need to put more time and effort into that, because in essence, you're going to need a lot more commissioners and a lot better trained people to handle this increase of the 30% caseload. To the managing of disputes, I think what will be good, when the new legislation does come in, I can't see it being implemented for another year, but when it does come in, the avoidance of that many strikes, I think, will be a benefit to you. It might actually drop some of your caseload that you've got now because of the legislation might actually avoid some of those strikes that shouldn't be strikes at the time. In terms of training, I'm really pleased you're thinking of expanding the shop steward training, because I think that's the bulwark. Shop steward training would probably avoid disputes and probably shorten disputes if you have people coming and representing at the CCMA. I do want to, of course, just as an aside, congratulate the CCMA and that the late Bernica has received in the Tilly Awards. Congratulations to the CCMA for that. You mentioned the ILO, and you heard from the DG that we're spending quite a lot of money on the ILO. We could get some help from them with regard to training and input. They've handled national minimum wages around the world, and maybe we should now demand some of our spend back and let them come here and help us with some training. Just an idea, and I think they've done that in other jurisdictions, and we should be now demanding our pound of flesh, as it were. In terms of the bargaining councils, I've noticed a massive weakening across the board in the bargaining councils. I know you're spending money on them, but I'm seeing that the disputes aren't being settled. Most of them are going, they're not meeting the targets that you've got for settling disputes. I don't know what's happened there, but it seems to have fallen apart. The private agencies, that's something we should try and strengthen, because it could probably avoid some of the pressure on you. So much so, I know that many of the larger companies have private arbitration clauses in their employment contracts, and maybe you could go out there and sell that to the employment world, so that it's not all on your head. Let the companies solve their own, you know, if someone wants to SHYT, let them do it on their own doorstep, not yours. So just an idea as well, and if we could try and push it. The law accepts it, so let's try and push it. There seems to have been a move afoot in the CCMA over the past few years that they don't like the private arbitration agreements, but I think we should be encouraging it. Just another thing, an idea as well, and I have actually, I think about 2 years ago, I mentioned it to the CCMA in one of these discussions. We should actually have a consideration of gatekeeping. Many of the disputes that come to the CCMA are actually nonsense. I mean, I've taken a few myself, which in the end I've discovered is absolute rubbish. And we've spent 2 days arguing about something that shouldn't have been there in the first place. And the commissioners are quite good at gatekeeping. They should be given some power. And what I mean by gatekeeping, and I'm sure you understand, is that they look at the facts beforehand and say, actually, we don't have a commissioner sitting for 3 days arguing about this. Can't you just sort it out? And the gatekeeping could happen even before the conciliation. And I have noted now, finally, and thank you for giving me that leeway, Madam Chair, the budget is not for the national minimum wage. Now, the DG says that in June you can then approach them and see if you can claw some money back. Well, that might be too late. We've got to start training people. We've got to start in this country to know that when we do have a national minimum wage, I don't think it's going to come this year, everyone disagrees with me, but when it does come, we've got to hit the ground running, because then disputes will come. Now, if people aren't trained and aren't there and officers aren't available, and you can imagine the chaos. But someone's going to say, I haven't been paid, I'm supposed to get my national minimum wage, I haven't been paid it, I want it heard within the 30 days. There's going to be no one there to actually service it. I don't know how, I mean, it takes about a year to train a commissioner. We haven't even started. So we can have fancy legislation. We've got fantastic labor laws in this country about all sorts of things. Most of it isn't even implemented because just no one's around to oversee it, and no one's around to adjudicate on it. And can you imagine with the national minimum wage? It is great. We all walk around with our chests out saying we've now got a national minimum wage, but there's nothing to implement. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Baker. Honourable Mashiri, just to indicate, Honourable Baker, you requested that you want to be excused at 12:45, and it's already 1 o'clock. Honourable Mashiri?
Possibly did not mean that. The chairperson, I think there are just a few things that I just wanted to raise. Slide 7 and slide 8, the target. Surely target of the nature of annually does not assist you to manage performance. They don't. Unless I have to be schooled a little bit, because the intent of the target is to actually manage your own performance to achieve your own goals. But if you make target of annual, you may sit from January until to November, hoping that you'll do it in December. Then you fail in December. Then you've done nothing. And I'm not sure, but I don't believe that the target of the annual target, especially those that exceed 1 unit, above 1 unit, I don't think that they assist you. And I mean, you have got one that says quarterly, and you've got 24 of those that want to do, but want to do it quarterly. You are not dividing it by 4 and half, and know that for the first quarter how many are doing. And the other one on slide 8, I just want to understand whether you mean what my English means. The first one, where you have biannual, then you have got two collective bargaining, whatever that you are planning to do biannual. This biannually, are you referring to once in 2 years, or are you referring to one in 6 months? What is the meaning of biannually? Because my English says it's 2 years. In 2 years, is that what you mean? And then it doesn't assist us if that is the case. I think you need to relook at that. I don't think you meant 2 years. You may have meant other semester or something like that. Chair, the slide number 13. If one has understood what you have been saying and the cry that you are having about the budget, but slide 13 tells us that it is your own baby that you produced. If one goes through that slide 13, and there is no indication where Treasury has actually frustrated you. The process that you have undertook to produce the budget until the Executive Committee at the bottom and then the governing body, whatever, then approves your budget. And then you cry that there is no money to do X, Y, Z. And I really just wanted to know that what that slide means. It's exactly what you want me to understand, or there is a hidden hand that frustrated you in this particular budget. Because, Chair, my understanding is that the cry about the implementation of the national minimum wage, I think it is not supposed to exist now. That cry is not supposed to exist now. There is no act called national minimum wage. It's not there. And then it doesn't really ask for financial resources to be put in. We don't have that act. We don't have that mandate now. All what you have is just simply for you to plan for it when it comes, then you say, no, 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 there it is. If you want me to do this, then I'll need this. Then they'll have to deal with it in the mini budget, if ever it happens before the mini budget. For now, you don't even need to make noise and cry, because you don't have that mandate until the act is signed. I think that is the time that we'll possibly talk about that issue of the national minimum wage implementation. Thanks, Chairman.
Thank you, Honorable Mashine. Then it's the Honorable Nadisha, then the Honorable Kurai.
I'm covered, Chief.
Thank you, Honorable Kurai.
Thank you, sir. Sir, I'm not sure whether the question that I'm going to put is the one that has been put by Honorable America. One, how do you make, how do you account the money that you have collected or you have charged, which are not part of your APP, and how do you make an enforcement that money must be paid? And this one of the, to make the bargaining council to account, how do you make the bargaining council to pay? I think that's a question. Thanks.
Are you done? No.
Yes.
Thank you. We'll give over to the department to do.
Thank you, Chair. Just three points that I would like to make. One, on the funding for the CCMA, to deal with the enforcement. In the law, we've made provision for the cost recovery mechanism for non-compliance. So what it means is that companies who do not comply will have to pay the cost of the CCMA during the case. And we've asked CCMA to develop a cost structure for that. I think that will go a long way in helping them to to recover whatever they would have spent in one, preparing for the implementation of the national minimum wage, two, for any unforeseen expenditure that they will have. And thirdly, it will make sure that they always have money available to hear the cases. And that's the contingency plan that we put in place and make problem for the law. And of course, I don't think that will be enough. There will be other things that they need to do, and that's why we still have to go to national treasury and ask for more funding. The second point is the pity that Honorable Barbara is not here. He raised the issue of dispute prevention. I often say to the National Director of System A that we don't say much about the Senzumehluko strategy, which is focusing more on dispute prevention. And the caseload that they have is a symptom of the failure to prevent the disputes at the source. So I think we need to spend more resources in the implementation of that strategy, and we will be working closely with the SME to make sure that strategy is implemented and published. It's a beautiful strategy. The third point, Shay, on the training that Honorable Patrick, the training has already commenced. We currently on a roadshow talking to people around that time, we're jointly as a department. We're currently training a number of people on the national minimum wage. And talking to the director of he has made arrangements already to train the commissioner on how to deal with the issues of the that will come to the attention of the commissioner when we implement the national minimum. So we're not waiting for the adjustment to the budget in June. And already what has come in. Thank you.
Thank you, DJ.
Thank you very much, DJ. The contribution. Let me deal with the rest of the question. In line with what the DJ has said now in terms of the cost, Honorable American, as matter stands now, there is a rule that makes provision for us to award costs. But I'm sure the essence of your question is we are not doing it as a court would do, as a court recovery mechanism. The difficulty that we have with this one, it is a matter of social justice, stroke equity. Because when you in a case are sitting with an employer and an employee, the majority of cases, if not all of them, are referred by employees. And most of that, 75% of the cases that we have is unfair dismissal. And in all those cases where the award says that the dismissal is unfair, we rarely award costs there. Really, we don't award costs there. The only costs that you see are the procedural ones, that is, in terms of section number 40, where there's been a procedural defect, and there's an award fee that we charge. The reason why it's like that is because it tried to distinguish the CCMA from a court, that people should not be afraid to raise cases or refer cases to the CCMA because they're afraid of the cost order. The side effect of this is that if an employee refers a case to the CCMA and says, I have been unfairly dismissed, the award says the dismissal is fair. What you're going to find is an employer saying, because the case is dismissed, it means the case did not have merit in the first place, award costs against the employee because he should not have brought it in the first place. So the court and the judicial approach of the result, the cost must follow the result, we considered that. But what we saw was the side effect of that would be that the 75% cases of those that refer cases may end up with that cost order over and above them being unemployed and being dismissed. So it's going to instill a fear factor to somebody who thinks that the case has been dismissed. And also, if you look at the level of cases or the employees who refer the case, it's not from the domestic workers. So if they know that if I lose a case, I might be made to pay the employer for having brought the case in the first place, then they decide not to refer the case. So we then consciously looked at that from the equity point of view and said, this might not work. But there are instances where costs are being awarded. And in the majority of cases, it is when there's been a postponement which was unwarranted. We would grant costs in that regard. Where you find a party misbehaving in the course of the proceedings, we would award costs in that. We developed guidelines of what we call the arbitration guidelines, where we set out 15 points that must be considered by a commissioner when they award compensation, and while doing that, consider those factors in the context of costs. And I think what we will need to do here is to review that and see in the current system that we have, because some cases should not be defended. You know, there's just no case. Even if you look at the evidence, you'll hear that the process, yes, I dismissed him, and then because I don't want him, but you follow the wrong process and the wrong reason is wrong. On the face of it, there's nothing that makes what you award cost. Sometimes you even award punitive cost. Because of the attitude that the employer has adopted. And others just tell me that I didn't care if it's wrong, the dismissal, but I don't want this employee. So there are cases where we can consider that here are the parameters and guidelines. If any of these happen, we must grant the cost order and be able to pursue it. And that comes back into our cover, which then will fit into that. But at least the comfort that we have is that we do have in law the power to grant cost order. We just have to relook at how we do that. Because some of the parties, especially on the employer side, they would come to the CCMA loaded with heavy legal representation. Unilever's senior counsel, all the matters that doesn't warrant it. So if you were to lose a case against this employer and award a cost against an employer and cost that, so you're going to run into problems. But if they do that, but they know that they don't have a case, you must have the power to say, but you know, with the capacity that they have, with the people that you have, you should have known that you should not have developed a method of this nature and talk about issues of cost. So it is a very good idea. We will definitely look at that and how, especially during the time now, when we review our rules and see how we can deal with the award cost portion, because the Act does recognize it and in the context that the teacher explained. Who holds bargaining councils accountable? It's a split function here between us and the department. I think what we need to do is to now clearly define exactly, because in as far as the system is concerned, we are credit bargaining council, and we hold them accountable in terms of the policy that we created, about 7 or 8 items, impartiality, management, capacity of the people to do that, and issues of the effective administration and management of the institution. The only teeth we have, if they don't meet those policy requirements, is not to accredit us, and we rarely do so. But there's another accounting line that goes to the Department of Labor as far as the bargaining councils are concerned. For us, I think what needs to happen is a question of consolidation there, because there must be a clear line of accountability. Let me just sum up the question that has to do also with the money. The bargaining councils receive a subsidy from the CCMA. The whole idea why they receive a subsidy is because they are doing what the CCMA should be doing. We are encouraging them to do that function. They are quarterly monitoring systems that we have that monitors what we give them, because they submit claims with proof attached on them before we even give. So we are able to do that. But I must accept that that system can be improved. It can be improved, because sometimes others, what they do, they would have these claims and not claim until the end of the financial year. Then they bring a bulk of claims. Now you sit with a bulk of documents, verification becomes a problem. There's time pressure because the financial year is ending. So we've got that misbehavior which we're trying to do. But I do accept one part, that in terms of accountability, it can be better, because what we are trying to develop also is an early warning system that will detect if something wrong happens in the bargaining council, not to intervene when it has collapsed, like in the MIPC situation, for example. So we need to improve on that management part. But the problem we have from the CCMA point is that we have only 2 professionals who deal with 36 bargaining councils. Only 2. And the capacity for us to do that is highly limited. And my instruction is, you must visit each and every one of those bargaining councils. Don't just rely on the report they give you. Go into them and inspect on whether what is being presented by them, it is in order. And because it can be misled very easily. So we will improve on that one. Now, on the 30% increase, it is correct. It may be much more than that. Relatively speaking, the 30% increase is realistic. It's going to be, it's a conservative figure that we have raised. I think the DG has dealt with the dispute management prevention portion, that we need to spend more money in terms of transmission problem that we do. The universities project, that we should spend more money, yes, that's correct. With the universities that we have now, we've just had 2 entries now, University of the Northwest and University of KZN, have just joined among the other universities that are joining us there. It is achieving the objective that we wanted to create it for. One of the things that we're doing now is to increase also the material and the areas of specialization of the university, not just the basic training. So in terms of the other programs, I called all of these universities a month ago, and all of them, I said to them, we are reviewing the content of what you're training. You must take into account, in line with our strategy, on, for example, the dispute management prevention, the issue of the prohibitive cost that they're charging students to do their university. I mean, for Verizon, all of them, to charge 40,000 rand for something that we've been doing free of charge, and we get nothing from it, by the way. We're reviewing that as well. That we give you our important intellectual property material, you're using it to generate income, but we don't get a return on our investment. So I'm reviewing that, and we've met, and in 3 months' time, we're meeting for them to tell me how much, not whether they should give us money or not, how much are they giving us back. from that so that we can increase the partnership within that. And on the question of the collective bargaining engagement, I think the point is valid there. The early detection and early engagement by us in the collective bargaining process to avoid some of these things that I think is what we are trying to do in terms of our strategy. So that is a point. The training of the shop stewards, these were increasing and there's a high demand on it. A very, very high demand. Our conference has been a learning curve for us that we retain, we're going to do it every year, but there's other smaller trainings that we use for shop stewards to make sure that there's effective appearance. I went also in the COSA to labor school, where I presented some of the shortcomings that we experienced as the commission. For example, if a shop steward comes to our cases unprepared, it's an offense to those that you represent. You can't do that. You can't come unprepared to a case. You have to prepare very well, because the life of that person that you represent hangs in your hands. It's just not another case. So for those that do that, they must be dealt with, because you can't allow that. Otherwise, don't do it. Or if you do it, then do it well. That's among the things. The second issue that we raised was those who are moonlighting. You're a shop steward, but on the other side, you're getting clients that appear before the CCMA, but using the ticket of a union. That is unlawful. And we've got such people, and we've reported that in the labor school. So we gave them a long list of things relating to the shop steward, but what we are going to do, we are going to provide at what I call the shop steward toolkit, both on the dispute of parties and the dispute of interest, that we train them on both. The dispute of interest is collective bargaining issue, dispute of rights is the cases that they normally do, and capacitates them there, because most of our people can't afford legal representation. Their only hope is in the unions and representing them very well. Our duty as the commission is to train them and make sure that they can meet the skill that employers are bringing. That's what we want to achieve, and that's what we're doing. With more resources, we can make it better as well. The Benin Award, yes, we were very proud to receive that letter and the recognition of Benin, the role that it played at NEDLAC in the production of the minimum wage. It's something that stands out that we're very proud of. Assistance from the ILO. In December, in 2016, we signed a memorandum of understanding and agreement with the ILO. This is intended to do exactly what Honorable Bakker is saying, that ILO must assist us, including, you see, most of the things that you find in the Labor Relations Act and also the minimum wage, it's not a domesticated principle, it's a global principle. And the ILO has been doing this for years in different countries, so we must be able to benefit from them. When we did our minimum wage conference, we invited ILO, and they did a very effective presentation on the issue of minimum wage, its application, the shortcomings, and what happens in other countries. When we also made submissions to the portfolio committee, because we prepared time for it, because we wanted to make sure that it's successful, some of the principles that we presented come from the ILO conventions, which are applicable locally. So, in as far as assistance is concerned, when we arrange certain events, ILO does participate, but we need to then expand the assistance that they can give us in doing some of the training, especially on the one that deals with ILO. One of the other projects that we're pursuing now is the one with the agricultural sector, where the ILO is involved, with some funding that they have to assist the agricultural sector. Our interest in the agricultural sector is that, you know, if you want to find the true definition of vulnerable, you'll find it in the agricultural sector. The employees that work in the farms, you will find the perfect definition of that. So when we design our rules and when we do what we do currently, we must do it in such a way that it does not exclude such people. So the program that we're doing in the ILO and that we'll be pursuing is exactly how we accommodate AgriSA. We approached AgriSA, we entered an agreement with them that when we develop a specialist training and a specialist commissioner, they will participate so that the factors that affect the industry are taken into account on how we regulate our rules and how we deal with our cases. So we've agreed and we're fine with the CFO. So therefore, we've received positive response from them with regards to that. Now, in as far as the bargaining council and the settlement, it is common cause, Chairperson, that when it comes to settlement of cases, our settlement sets about 70%. But the biggest one, the biggest problem we have is in the public sector. The public sector does not settle cases. They don't. It's always one answer, and we all know that, but is we don't have money. So the case proceeds. But it's affecting the worker, because you are giving away an opportunity to settle a case with the lowest as you can by not having the money. We've raised it with the board, we've raised it in our committee of the board, our accreditation and subsidiary committee, that we must approach the state here in as far as the settlement issue is concerned, because it is the biggest problem. That part we do accept. And in the bargaining councils, that's where you feel it the most, because we set the standard for the panelists to participate in the bargaining council. When we review their contracts, one of the things that we expect of them is the settlement issue. But one of the problems they have when they can't meet the settlement ratio is because they say, we work in the bargaining council of the public sector. The public sector does not settle. So that's the result of that. So that's where the problem is. So it's something that is beyond our control. Only the state can change that. Strengthening of the private agencies, absolutely. We've taken a clear decision here that the private agencies must be strengthened for them to exist like and produce a number of the top resource type of institutions. And so that there's no debate about that. The gatekeeping principle is a very difficult one, a very tricky one. Because sometimes you do find wrong referral. In some of the cases, somebody says, I have not been paid my money. Then they fill in the referral form and says, I've been unfairly dismissed. When you sit with the applicant, say, but all I want is my money to be paid. But that's the wrong referral. You know, sometimes it's because not knowing. Sometimes people feel I can get help. How you now deal with that is a very difficult and a very tricky thing. Because the only time you know that it's wrong referral is when they're already at the hearing room. You can't know prior to that. If they say unfairly dismissed, then it's within our jurisdiction, you can't change them away. What we've introduced is what we call the pre-conciliation. Pre-conciliations, you do it telephonically as well. You can phone the employer, on, especially on the domestic cases, because you don't want those, you know, we call them Madam and Eve, that somebody who's a domestic worker must, they have no money, let alone what they're paying. They've been paid below the minimum wage. So for them to come to the case, get postponed, to conciliate, and come back for arbitration, it is problematic. We developed this tool called a pre-conciliation, where we can do it telephonically. If it's agreed, then the matter is finalized, but that's fine. You can also determine the facts while you're doing that. But commissioners do exercise this thing of checking if there's a case or not. But as at that time they do that, a cost is incurred. Because we pay a commissioner for sitting and opening the file. Already at that time, the charge is running. So the gatekeeping principle for what it's trying to do is not helping very much. So the nature of the cases that we have is quite difficult to do so. The pre-training, in as far as, I think the Honourable Mashida's question is linked to this one. I'll deal with it also with slide number 13. Member Chairperson.
Can you try and wrap up in 2 minutes, please?
In 2 minutes, okay, let me talk. Now, you see, the amendments that we're talking about on the minimum wage, basically the Employment Act, they come at a time when we are not even done with the 2015 amendment. We're dealing with that problem. You see, the effect of amendments, you don't feel it in the year of amendment, you feel it a year after. And it would be suicidal to wait for the legislation before you act. It's too late then. Because if you wait, as we say then, if you wait, it means number one, your commissioners are not ready to handle the case because they don't know the new law. Your case management officers are exactly in the same position. The labor market does not know how to deal with it. So if you wait for the law, before you do all of those things, you are heading for disaster. So what we've said in all amendments, a lot of work happens before the act becomes law. So that by the time the law starts, we are on point. So to do it that way around will really be suicidal. If you look at the slide 13 on the machine, that is an internal process of the system. That's how we do our budget. It goes to the Audit and Risk Committee, which is composed of all your financial people, risk people, and everybody else, and then they recommend to the governing board decision. We can only ask for the budget based on the slice that we get from them. We can't do anything beyond that. Even the slice what they have is not sufficient. So the cry for more money is louder and bigger, actually, because in this process we know what we don't have and what we need. And so that process is the one that tells us exactly that what we need. So the CAI, is absolutely justified because a lot of work has been done prior to that. So I know about some of things, but then I think the others are definitely indirect. And for that we need the money, our reasons are that we're hiding the money. I must talk to drivers and computers in challenge 1 million and 2.
thank you, Mr. Fellow M, for that one. Members, there we have it. I don't think there's follow-up questions in terms of that. We are heading to the last presentation. I've noted you, the Honourable Martin,
Thank you, Chair. In regard to productivity, South Africa, we have gone through the presentations. I thought it might be propitious if we give the presenter a chance to deal with the pertinent issues, more so that you are constrained in terms of time, streamline work.
Thank you. I think it's noted. Over to you,
Professor. Chairperson and members, good afternoon. If you look on slide 6, then slide 6 and 7 actually covers the problems of productivity to the extent that you go to the slide that talks to so that we assess their productivity deficiencies as
government so that we save those jobs. So you find that most of the targets that are reflected in the APP are actually specific to that. This is a program that is being funded by the Unemployment Insurance Fund. The other thing that I just want to reflect on is on slide 16. Because of those things that I said, particularly around the work that we do with the DTI, these are the sectors that we are focusing on: agriculture, energy, ICT, manufacturing, and mining, because these are productive sectors of the economy. We believe that here, if you intervene here, you will get more traction in terms of employment growth. And these are the sectors that are actually very prominent in the industrial policy action plan. So our focus is on this, and that is why the DTI spent over 9 million to support them in this program. So that's in essence how our budget is structured. One is funding from the department, 53 million. The next is funding from the UIF. Then the third is funding from the DTI. I think I summarized it.
Thank you very much, sir. Very happy to hear that. Do we have any questions? I think it's clear to us. We did receive the presentations in advance. So, the Honorable Mashile.
Well, Chair, it's a small group of people. I mean, it's almost no funds really. I'm sorry to talk about this. What I'm looking at is around 300,000. Is that correct? That they are turning around? Because when I'm looking at the units of the figures, it looks like they are, as they look at the table, the 287,646 revenue or something like that. But the issue, Chair, it looks like it's an entity that's crossing DTI, Community Development, and Labour. It's just putting mangled in all of them. Are you currently productive yourself as an institution? Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Mashile. Can you quickly respond to my question?
Yes, we are. From the sense that if you look at the issues around job preservation, there's a slide where we've actually given you the outcome of what we did in 2017-18. And if you look at particularly the workplace challenge program, I think if we could give more focus and resources in that direction, actually this is a program that can make a serious dent in terms of employment growth. So yes, we are very productive as an entity. In essence, we are now starting a movement in the country where we mobilize industry as well as society to be productive. The unfortunate situation is if you look at the competitiveness of countries in terms of one of the studies that we do annually, we're not taking well. And that's an area that we actually have to change as a country. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Martin.
The question that you have not spoken to, sir, is a question that my colleague pushed. Do you have an adequate budget to carry out your functions?
The budget that we have reflected there, if we receive all of it on time and in full, will be able to carry out it. We particularly funding from, if you look at it, the largest part of it comes from the Unemployment Insurance Fund. We get it on time and in full, we are capable to carry our money.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think concerns were raised in previous financial years in terms of the budget, the transfers being done later for the entity to suffer that was not from. So the indication is to receive their transfers internally. Was that then taken into consideration at our last presentation? So we want to thank the members. The department and the entity for their performance, for giving us insight into what's happening and preparing us for the budget and ultimately to grow you towards the audit outcome. But I'm sure there's no areas of concern that we have to worry in terms of at this stage. But for those few words, I want to officially declare this meeting closed. And I want to inform you.